My subject today is One Man's Anatomy of an Illness. My text is Psalm 103, page 521, if you'd like to follow me along. And I will begin reading with verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good as long as you live, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. My text is a phrase in verse 3, who heals all your diseases. Let us pray silently for a moment. In Christ's name, amen. The story that I share with you today is intensely personal. And because it is so personal, it is not at all easy for me to share it with you. It is the story not of the courage of this man, but of the adequacy of Jesus Christ. I share this story with the hope and the prayer that it will help someone in similar circumstances. I suspect that Carl Jung was wiser than he knew when he said, "Only the wounded doctor can heal." To give you an appropriate perspective on all that I say today, I will relate to you a series of events that are today more than 5 years old. The events in the order of their occurrence are my father's death, my representation of the Presbyterian Church in this country at the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland in Edinburgh in May of 1981, and a reception given on June 14, 1981, here at the church, celebrating the 25th wedding anniversary of ours and the 10th anniversary of my coming to be the pastor of this church. On December 21, 1980, the Sunday before Christmas, at approximately 5:30 a.m., my father died. Within minutes of his death, my brother Fred had called me. I had talked to my father the evening before he died. I had visited with him 2 days before his death. Sarah and both of our daughters had been in bed with flu, and one of them had pneumonia. And they were still asleep, so I did not awaken them. I dressed quickly and came to the church, made some necessary telephone calls early in the morning, and preached that day all three of the services. I will never forget what a comfort it was to me to be in the worship services that day, to hear the great music of Christmas, to feel the affirmation and joy of the Christmas story, and to sense that God was near, to look out on the faces of people that I love like family, and to share in the worship service was very helpful to me. And at the end of the 11 o'clock service, I announced that my father was dead and moved quickly to fly to South Carolina. When I got home, the funeral arrangements were made for Tuesday, and I discovered in my father's personal papers a letter addressed to me in which he requested that I was to conduct his funeral. And so there I stood in the old church where I was nourished and shaped in the faith as a boy, conducting and sharing in my father's funeral. I had the service of committal at the graveside and returned home and shared in the three services here on Christmas Eve and preached on national television at 11 o'clock on Christmas Eve. One of the most difficult aspects of my father's promotion to the church triumphant was that the private and personal grief that was mine had to be combined with the public and obvious responsibilities and duties that were mine. And that was a providential lesson that I learned that day. As I recall today, all of the events associated with my father's passing, I am now conscious of a growing sense of fatigue. I associated the fatigue with the reality of my father's death and the fact that for some months, since September, in fact, when we had moved to three services of worship, that I had been preaching all three of the services every Sunday and carrying in general what was then becoming an increasingly demanding schedule. The fatigue that I felt persisted. It in fact grew, and more I realized that I had very little energy. And what I had was waning. I disguised this from my family because my assumption was that if I could make it to vacation, my energies would be renewed with rest, and upon my return in the fall of 1981, I would no longer be preaching all three of the services of worship each Sunday. There were Sundays during that time when, between services, I would lie down on the floor of my study to rest a bit, to renew my capacity to continue through the morning. And all of this was very new to me because I have always been blessed with boundless energy and with boundless strength. During that time, I continued to play racquetball, though felt very depleted afterwards instead of the exhilaration that exercise usually brings. My memory reminds me that even though I was fatigued and generally weak, I was still winning a large portion of those games. It says something about the quality of my opposition on the court, but nonetheless, I was very depleted in terms of energy. In May 1981, I represented our church at the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland and was asked to preach on the General Assembly Sunday in the Mother Church of Presbyterianism, St. Giles Cathedral. It was on that trip that we were invited by the Pope to be received in a private audience. And on May 13th, 1981, my birthday, we were standing by the papal throne when His Holiness John Paul II was shot and grievously wounded. From Warm, we went to Edinburgh, Scotland, where we were the guest of Dr. and Mrs. David Steele. The round of official dinners and receptions we had to attend, including a state banquet at the Palace of Holyrood, the Queen's official residence in Scotland, were picturesque. I can tell you now what I have never said before, and that is, with private energy running out and a growing inner concern about my health, I knew that I was headed toward a private ordeal of some kind. In addition to the fatigue that was growing, I was now experiencing from the crown of my head to the soles of my feet a maddening itching which I attributed to stress and which my doctors believed were an allergy. In the early morning hours after we had been in Scotland for about a week, something unusual happened. I awakened. I usually go to sleep before I hit the bed, and I don't wake up until Sarah bounces me out. But I woke up in the dead of night, and I felt a great weakness and a sense of impending dread. I was possessed with a great urgency to return home, and it was then that I knew that I was seriously ill. I knew not what, but I knew something very bad was wrong. We made arrangements and returned to Atlanta several days earlier than had been originally planned. I immediately went to see my doctors. Walter Hood, who has been my physician and my friend for many years, ordered up all kinds of tests. Because of this maddening itching, he sent me to a dermatologist. All tests proved to be negative, and the prevailing view among my doctors was that I was suffering stress and fatigue, that I was reaping the harvest of too many years of unremitting work, too many 18-hour days without adequate rest and renewal. Other tests were ordered, x-rays were taken, and on June 4, 1981, Dr. Hood found a sizable tumor involving lymph nodes in my mediastinum. I still can't spell mediastinum, and I, at that point, did not know that I even had one. The mediastinum is an area or cavity right under where you tie your necktie, and in that cavity, they discovered a sizable tumor. And the third event in this narrative of preparation was held on June 14th, 1981, a reception honoring Sarah and myself on our 25th wedding anniversary and the 10th anniversary of our coming to be the pastor of this church. Unknown to all of you, I had spent the previous week in Emory Clinic and Emory University Hospital. I had undergone exploratory surgery to make and confirm a diagnosis. During that week, I returned my telephone calls from the hospital room. I read and asked questions of my physicians, had a few visits from the staff of the church. Only Mrs. John Hardy, then my secretary, and a few members of the staff, and a few members of the administrative committee knew that I was hospitalized. I was released on Saturday, June 14, 1981. I preached the 11 o'clock service on June 13, 1981. I preached the 11 o'clock service on June 14, 1981, and at 4 o'clock, we stood in a receiving line at this reception. I stood that day with Sarah in the receiving line with a confirmed diagnosis of cancer, to be specific, Hodgkin's disease. And if you have to have cancer, that's the best kind you can have. I not only had a favorable type, but a favorable stage, but cancer nonetheless. As I stood in the receiving line that day, family beside me, friends before me, it was, to put it mildly, a wrenching experience. We were all celebrating, and I did not want to spoil that mood, but my inner mood was not celebrative. I was exhausted from the test and the disease, pondering my future, ready to get on with my treatments, which my doctors had arranged to begin on Tuesday of the following week. The ordeal of discovery and diagnosis was now over. The road to recovery and health was before me and just beginning. In light of that, you cannot imagine the sense of joy that I felt at the recent reception you gave for our 30th anniversary and in celebration of my 25th anniversary of ordination. Nathaniel Hawthorne said in the middle of the Civil War, "Lord, it is too present with me, too persistent, too painful. I want out of this." I know that feeling. But I believed then that I would get well, and I can tell you today that I am well. My doctors now believe that I am cured. August 17, 1986, marked 5 years since my last treatment. And all that has transpired during these years leaves me with a feeling of profound gratitude. William Law, the mystic, asked the question, "Who is the greatest saint?" And his answer was that it is not the man who prays the most, it is the man who is the most thankful. For as long as I live, I shall live under the shadow of a great indebtedness to God for his mercy and for my recovery. I shall be eternally indebted to family, to doctors, to friends for their steadfast support and encouragement through this time. I have felt and continue to feel the great support of the prayers of many of you. And I can tell you today that I am almost grateful for my illness, for I am today a better human being because of it. I have a sense of inner peace and wholeness to my life that was not present to the degree before I was sick. One of the aspects of my illness that deepened and strengthened was my faith in God. I sensed his nearness in special ways. I felt his presence in ways that I never felt before. On the second Sunday after my diagnosis, during the 9:30 service of worship here in this sanctuary, I felt an overwhelming sense of peace and the quiet assurance that I would get well. I am not a mystical man. In fact, I spend most of my time muddling my way through, but I knew that day that God had assured me that I would get well. I am a man of many books, but I can tell you today that one book above all others helped me during my illness, the Bible. In particularly the story of our Lord, his teachings, his parables, his compassion for people in need. The Psalms helped me probably as much as the teachings and stories of Christ. For the Psalms speak to the full gamut of life, the good, the sordid, and the in-between. Joy and despair, success and disappointment, happiness and heartbreak. It's all there. And when you are reading with an intuitive and an attentive heart, God will speak to you and give you hope and peace. I have selected as my text for today Psalm 103. Lloyd Ogilvie calls it a psalm of rejuvenated exuberance. And the psalmist describes in that psalm one who redeems and ransoms, restores and renews, so that your youth is renewed like the eagle's. The image of the eagle is poignant. The secret of the eagle's power is not in its wings, but in the air currents that lifts it to the heights it could not attain on its own. The eagle's strength is multiplied by the hidden currents that support, and so are we. It is God's strength and power that sees us through and lifts us up. And so I can say with the psalmist today, all that is within me blesses his holy name. I stand before you with a profound sense of gratitude, with a renewed sense of destiny, and with a need to praise with lips and with life God's holy name. There are those present who have cancer, and that your diagnosis may not be as positive as mine. There are others present with burdens that may never go away for you. There are those present who are caught in broken things, broken relationships that may never be mended. But I can tell you this, Christ is adequate for whatever comes to you and to me. In this story of my personal pilgrimage with illness, I really want to build my thoughts around four questions. What helped me the most? What did I learn? How have I changed? What does the future hold? There are so many things that helped me through this. A meaningful vocation that enabled me to continue to reach out to people instead of withdrawing into myself. The comfort and the stimulation of reading. Memories of my upbringing that gave me strength. But in articulating what helped me the most, it's very obvious. My family, they were a bulwark to me. I could not have made it without Sarah and our daughters and Harold, who, though not yet married to Vicky, was by then considered a member of the family. Henry Nguyen, in his book, The Wounded Healer, wrote, "We can survive almost anything in life if we know one person is waiting for us." When we initially got over the shock of my diagnosis and the need that I felt to protect my family, it was really one of the most meaningful experiences we've ever experienced. We found out that we were really a family. Simon and Garfunkel wrote some words in the 60s. "If I never loved, I never would have cried. I am an island, and a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries." Friends, your pastor is not a rock. He often cries. And my family made a difference. in their caring and in their support. And I want to say about Sarah, my wife of 30 years, that she is indispensable to me. And I can tell you how she feels about me. She's bonkers about me. Agatha Christie, the mystery writer, her second husband was an archaeologist, Lord Mallowan. And somebody asked her what it was like to be married to an archaeologist. And her reply is delightful. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. For the older I get, the more interested he is in me. That's how Sarah feels about me. I could not have made it without my family, their love and support. My doctors were not only competent, they were without exception caring and intuitively understanding. They knew that I had a need to know whatever it was, all of the details, what their best just judgment for the future was. And they told me the facts without robbing me of the therapeutic quality of hope. Walter Hood, the first thing he said to me was, "You've got a mass in your chest, but we are going to make you well." Charlie Hatcher, the head of Emory Clinic, mobilized the resources of that great medical center. And Dr. Joseph Miller and Jim Keller have become among the dearest friends that I have. And David Lawrence of this congregation spent a great deal of time with me and my family and was present when I had exploratory surgery. My doctors, without exception, were caring, and they gave me sound advice. They advised me not to make any public statement of my illness. They were correct in that judgment because I needed all of the strength that I could muster for dealing with the illness and the treatments, and could not have handled, frankly, the many questions that would have come from all of you and others. One of them said to me as we discussed this, and not all of those who were advising me agreed with this position, but I made the final decision not to make any announcement. One of them said a very wise thing. He said, "Preacher, if you announce to that congregation that you have cancer, half of the congregation will canonize you, the other half will bury you." Well, I thought about canonization, but I felt that sainthood did not fit this sinner. And frankly, burying seemed decidedly premature. My friends helped me. Khalil Gibran once remarked that we can forget those with whom we've laughed, but we can never forget those with whom we have cried. Most friendships that are worth anything are those that are founded and nourished in human struggle. Once you have suffered with one another, there is a bonding that cannot be broken by the mere passage of time. There are so many friends that I could mention here, but time does not permit me to do so. Let me say, though, that I am grateful to Harry Crawford, who was and is so helpful to me. Often, at great inconvenience to himself, he drove me to Emory Clinic to take my radiation therapy, and then would drive me back here to the church or to wherever I had an appointment for me to meet my responsibilities. And when he could not do it, Bill Mills, the chairman of the pulpit nominating committee that brought me to this church, drove me. And it was during this experience that Chuck Mann, who has always been my friend, became and remains to this day my pastor. Family, friends, doctors, I was helped by all of that and by my faith. I don't know how anyone faces the challenge of a life-threatening illness or a life disruption of any kind without faith. You have to have some faith that will steady the boat when the tide begins to ebb. We often describe faith as a leap of faith. It's an apt expression, for faith is always leaping across the chasms that exist between the known and the unknown, the proven and those things we cannot prove, the actual and the possible, the hope and the dream and the reality. There's always a gap to be crossed in life. I am pressed by today, and I'm not sure that I will be equal for tomorrow. That's the human condition. So in faith, we live today, and we leap into tomorrow with expectancy and hope. Theodore Ferris, one of my teachers, the rector of Trinity Episcopal Church in Boston, and a great preacher, died of cancer. And just a few months before he died, he said, "O Lord, make me well and strong. But if this be not thy will, help me to use my weakness to strengthen others. And if this be not thy will, in my weakness, let me lean on thee." Get some faith. Get some faith for life's ebbing tide, some faith for the rainy days. Get some faith, for without faith, the way will ultimately be enclosed in darkness. Well, there were a lot of things that helped me. What did I learn? Oscar Wilde, in his De Profundis, said, "Clergymen and people use phrases without wisdom sometimes, who use phrases without wisdom sometimes talk of suffering as a mystery. It is really a revelation. One discerns things never discerned before." The Pennsylvania Dutch have a saying, "Too soon old, too late smart." What a tragedy it would be to go through an illness and know the joy of recovery and not be changed and not learn anything. There are so many things that I learn which are beneficial to me today, and hopefully will be beneficial to you as I continue to minister. I learned the importance of hope. I don't believe anyone gets well who doesn't believe they're going to get well. Hope reinforces our capacity to fight back. My family was very important in this. I was not treated differently. We talked about my illness openly. My doctors constantly reinforced my sense of hope. There is a therapeutic quality of strength to be found in hope. I learned also that isolation is one of the great burdens of illness. Of necessity, only a few people knew about this. And one of the things that shocked me the most was about half of them dropped me like a hot potato. It was not that they did not care. It was simply that they could not handle the fact that their pastor, their friend, had cancer. So I learned that in the context of illness, in the cadre of your closest friends and associates, you experience love and support, continuing friendship and contact, the knowledge of their prayers. You also experience no contact, no sense of support, no supportive notes, no spontaneous telephone calls, and the result of all that is isolation. As I have worked my way through that, I can empathize with their feelings and their dilemma. But it did not make it any easier for me in my struggles. Since that experience, I am in tune to those who are ill in this church. Any friend, any member, we see to it, if we know about it, that there are consistent contacts, because one does not need to add to the burden of illness the burden of isolation. I learned how important it is to keep working. Through all of my radiation therapy, and I kept working, maintaining office routines. I kept preaching, doing all that I could. It was important to constantly continue to reach out, seeking to help others. And I think now that the helper was the one most helped. I would lie down between appointments. At the end of my therapy, I was so weak I could not drive. But I continued to see people. The day that this tumor was discovered in my chest, I had a luncheon appointment with a man who had lots of troubles. And in the immediate context of learning of my illness, I was listening to the troubles of another. Even that was helpful. Sarah worried about me during all that time, and one day she chastised me and said, you just got to quit all this and just take the rest of the summer off. And I said to her, "Sweetheart, I may in fact die young, but I'm not going to die bored." You cannot live in fear. Fear is immobilizing. I learned also that our faith will stand the test. What I have preached for 25 years, what I have sought to live for 50 plus years as a human being, friends, it will stand the test.